The newspaper coverage continues on this Friday, the 21st of August, 2026, on the Talking Information Center. Time now to start the reading of today's Boston Globe, and we say hello to Pamela.
Good morning, this is Pamela, and from the front page, concerns over flock detection intensify. At least four police officers in the state are under investigation for misusing the technology, and a wave of towns continue to opt out. For the third time in a week, police officers in Massachusetts were caught misusing flock safety's license plate camera network, raising questions about the lack of oversight of the surveillance technology that has quickly and quietly sprouted up across the country. Two officers in Lynn were placed on leave after an audit flagged a concerning pattern in their flock searches, officials said Wednesday. A day earlier, Stowe police said they would move to fire an officer and criminally charge him for allegedly tracking his ex-girlfriend. That followed a New Bedford police placing an officer on leave who was accused of stalking her ex-girlfriend. The misconduct was identified after a growing nationwide backlash prompted action on a number of fronts. People have been using a website, haveibeenflocked.com, to learn if their license plates had been a target of a flock search. The company rolled out a system that is supposed to flag questionable searches, and towns and police departments have started to tighten access and clamp down on misuse. We want to make sure that the privacy concerns are taken care of and that we still have this tool, which is really important to public safety, said Michael Bradley, president of the Massachusetts Chiefs of Police Association. The group has urged departments to conduct thorough audits of their flock systems and flag suspicious searches. But critics argue these changes don't address the key problems with the technology, which includes the widespread sharing of personal data and potential intrusive searches without police needing a warrant, as well as the cooperation of some departments with federal agents to find immigrants targeted for deportation. Some critics say it's time for the state to impose some restrictions or requirements, arguing that big tech or law enforcement cannot be trusted to police themselves. We need real legal protections, not promises from surveillance technology companies that may not be binding in practice, said Kate Crockford, Director for Technology and Justice Programs at the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, which is pushing for legislative action. Last week, Flock announced changes to its platform in response to the scrutiny that includes an auditing tool designed to flag patterns of misuse for review. Flock plans to require customers to use the auditing tool by the end of the year. Before, law enforcement agencies could decide whether to use the Flock tool or other auditing methods, if any at all. Flock will also require officers to enter a case number for all searchers and let departments limit the type of offenses that other agencies cite for searching their databases, such as prohibiting for immigration purposes. Flock's cameras photograph back of each passing vehicle, noting its location, license plate, make, color, and model, as well as bumper stickers or racks. In many cases, officers can access cameras from departments with which they hold a sharing agreement, a source of concern about out-of-state agencies searching the data without oversight and possibly on behalf of federal agencies. Both Stowe and New Bedford ordered their police departments to terminate their relationships with Flock shortly after the misconduct cases surfaced. In Lynn, police have restricted access to Flock to high-ranking supervisors as the department reviews its policies. Such reports of misuse and a slew of data privacy concerns sparked a nationwide furor against Flock, leading dozens of municipalities, including at least 13 in Massachusetts, to cancel or pause their contract with the company. In the latest case, Hopkinton terminated his contract on Thursday after officials said a legal review from the agreement did not comply with procurement law. Automated license plate reader technology has proven that it can be a very valuable tool, Hopkinton Interim Police Chief Scott Van Ralton said in a statement. Even so, we recognize that our community has raised legitimate concerns, and we take those seriously. Wellesley also entered a pilot with Flock this week. Police Chief Scott Whitmore said the single Flock camera the department tested was not making significant contributions to their work. The pilot was initially poised to run to the end of 2027. Some departments have proactively amended how they use the technology, rather than outright ceasing its use. After residents raised concerns, Quincy Police in June limited access to Flock's platform to only 50 officers out of its roughly 240. Searches are audited and must be conducted within the city's borders and associated with an investigation that has a case number, said Police Chief Michael Kennedy. I trust that my people do a great job, but we check and make sure they're using it appropriately, Kennedy said. Waltham started auditing its Phlox data when it first contracted with the company last year, said Detective Sergeant Patrick Dean. He said the AI-powered audits would supplement the department's human-conducted audits, not replace them. Salem announced in July the city is ending its Phlox contract due to data security concerns. Law enforcement officers seeking to assist ICE in Florida and Georgia had included Salem's records in their searches last year, according to Have I Been Phlox'd. Phlox piloted AI-powered audits earlier this summer. The company said the tool has already helped find cases of misuse, such as five officers in Albany, Georgia, who allegedly accessed the platform for non-law enforcement purposes. The Washington Post reported over 50 instances of officer misuse of Phlox, some for stalking and harassment. The company did not respond to requests for comment. In a July interview with The Globe, Phlox Chief Legal Officer Dan Haley said the growing reports of misuse are a good outcome of the company's accountability tools. Our opponents will point to that and yell, Phlox bad. We point to that and say we're really proud of that, he said. But some people doubt self-auditing will be sufficient to identify misconduct and have turned to data aggregation website to see if their license plate was searched in the system. One such resident is Corrine Eikens of Marshfield, who grew curious when she saw widespread reports of police misusing Phlox. She entered her license plate number on Have I Been Phlox'd and found an officer in Abington used Phlox in March of 2025 to track her driving activities over a seven-day period by searching 88 networks on the company system. The officer categorized the search reason as suspicious activity. But Eikens, 37, said she hasn't been in Abington in years. The officer discovered graduated high school with her. She said they didn't have any sort of relationship. I felt like my privacy had been violated, she said. I'm just an ex-classmate. Why did he look me up? Following a Globe inquiry, Abington Police Chief John Bonney said he was looking into the incident. He added the department regularly audits its officers' use of Phlox. Civil liberties groups and activists took the streets this week against Phlox, which is based in Atlanta, and other surveillance companies as part of the National Week of Action. More than 50 protesters marched to Phlox's Boston office in the Seaport on Wednesday, flashing signs emblazoned with the camera designs and chanting, Get the Phlox out. People are finally fighting back against surveillance state, said Fatima Ahmad, executive director of the Muslim Justice League advocacy group and one of the protest organizers. Critics say the new auditing tools are helpful, but only to a small extent, as they are essentially optional for police to act on. The Institute for Justice earlier this month released a database of license plate reader technology abuse and has identified more than 150 cases nationwide, which Michael Seufer, an attorney with the Institute, called a massive undercount. The Institute and other civil liberties groups have long pushed for technology to require warrants signed by a judge. If a warrant requirement was implemented, you would see the number of searches plummet, Seufer said. And they would only happen when there was a real reason for them, probable cause. Trump pushes fast work on ballroom, appears to try to outbuild the Supreme Court. With the fate of his ballroom tied up in court, President Trump is racing against the clock. He has enlisted a team of 250 workers to push ahead with construction 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, to complete as much work as quickly as possible. This week, there are plans to install 1 million pounds of rebar and pour 3,000 cubic yards of concrete for a project that is now two-thirds complete, the administration said in a court filing. Now, with a matter pending before the Supreme Court, the Trump administration is making a practical appeal to the justices. The ballroom is simply too far along to be stopped now. His strategy clearly is to change the reality on the ground, so that instead of preserving the status quo, those who rightly invoke the law against what he's doing are put in a position of having to undo something that's already a fait accompli, said Lawrence H. Tribe, an Emeritus University professor of constitutional law at Harvard. For years, Trump has argued that the White House should have its own ballroom, saying it was a matter of prestige on the world stage. A ballroom, he said, would allow officials to hold big events for special guests without needing to erect a tent on the south lawn. In recent months, as preservationists and other critics have tried to halt or at least slow down the project, Trump has offered a new justification: national security. Essentially, Trump is treating the ballroom and the military bunker underneath it as one and the same. The bunker, officially known as the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, or PEOC, was built during World War II beneath what was once the East Wing, which Trump tore down last year to make way for his ballroom. Now he speaks about the two projects in the same breath. After an armed man rushed the White House Correspondents Association dinner in April, for example, Trump said on social media that the mayhem had proved the need for the militarily top secret ballroom currently under construction at the White House. Trump demolished the East Wing last October without seeking any approvals or submitting construction or demolition plans to Congress. While he did bring the project before two review panels whose leaders he had appointed, Trump has continued to change the plans and the designs they authorized. Several federal court rulings have found that the president exceeded his authority by moving ahead without congressional approval, but the decisions have been paused pending appeals, which means the construction can go on at least until Friday, when an appeals court order to halt the above-ground construction goes into effect. The case is also pending before the Supreme Court. Joshua Fisher, a director of White House Management Administration, told the court that a concrete and steel superstructure had already been built that stretches 5 stories deep and 70 feet high. Fisher said 80% of the rebar for the project had been placed and the concrete poured. He said $335 million of the $400 million needed for the project had been raised from private donors. He estimated the construction was 65% complete. Fisher said the ballroom's columns were being carved by a renowned Italian artist, and the buildings would be sturdy enough to withstand a nuclear blast. Given the current progress, the superstructure is beyond the point of return, Fisher wrote. He added that even if the Supreme Court ordered the plans of the building altered or the building taken down, there would be no way to do so. The message was clear. The ballroom cannot be undone. But in a filing Tuesday, the preservationist challenging the project told the justices that the administration was trying to outrun judicial review by suggesting it was too late to stop the construction. They tell this court that because the ballroom is being built with a type of concrete used in nuclear power plants, it will soon be virtually impossible to deconstruct, according to the filing. Lawyers for the National Trust for Historic Preservation in the United States, a nonprofit chartered by Congress to guard America's historic buildings, said the administration had intentionally accelerated construction in an effort to put their illegal ballroom beyond judicial intervention. They have pointed to the Constitution and several federal laws that state Congress must approve such a project. One federal law says, a building or structure shall not be erected on any reservation, park, or public grounds of the federal government in the District of Columbia without express authority of Congress. Lower court judges have sided with the preservationists, ruling that Congress must first sign off on the expansion and renovation of the White House complex. Efforts to foil judicial review and arrogate Congress's exclusive powers should not be rewarded with a stay that allows petitioners to complete a ballroom they lacked any authority to commence in the first place, said the trust lawyers led by Thaddeus A. Heuer. In its filing Tuesday, the trust suggested that the Supreme Court temporarily halt the above-ground work and then quickly schedule oral arguments for October or November to formally decide whether the project can proceed. If the justices do not press pause now, the trust said, the project is on track to be substantially finished this fall, and it will be too late. This is an editorial. Mothers get lost in the shuffle. The Clancy trial highlights gaps in postpartum mental health care. Women suffer if mental health, substance use conditions go untreated. Lindsay Clancy, suffering from severe postpartum mental illness, killed her 3 children. Clancy's trial, which will determine whether she should be held criminally responsible, is raising questions about the quality of medical care she received. A civil lawsuit filed by her husband seeks to hold a psychiatrist, nurse, and two healthcare systems accountable. Clancy's tragedy is drawing attention because of its horrific and extremely rare outcome. But new parents are struggling to navigate more common postpartum mental health care daily. A report released in June by the National Partnership for Women and Families, based on a survey of 3,800 women's childbearing experiences, found that 60% of women with symptoms of anxiety or depression immediately before, during, or after pregnancy were not treated with counseling or medication. Eugene DeClercq, a Boston University professor who studies maternal and childbirth policy, said the barriers to obtaining treatment can range from not taking the problem seriously to not being able to find a provider while navigating life with a newborn. "We so strongly prioritize babies that sometimes mothers get lost in the shuffle," DeClercq said. Clancy's trial provides an opportunity to consider how, as a state, we can improve access to and quality of care for people with postpartum mental illness. That can involve enhancing communication between healthcare providers, better integrating mental and physical health care, and expanding the pool of mental health providers. It's hard as a provider to see folks individually get called out, in the Clancy case, when it's really about a system that's onerous to navigate, said Lena Mittal, a reproductive psychiatrist in private practice. When not treated appropriately, mental illness can be fatal. According to a June report by the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, there were 153 pregnancy-associated deaths of mothers in Massachusetts between 2019 and 2023. And in 42%, the underlying cause was a mental health condition, a category that includes substance use disorders. These deaths could include suicides, overdoses, or an exacerbated medical condition, like if a drug use worsened preeclampsia. One theme that emerged from trial testimony was Clancy was receiving care from different providers who prescribed medications but did not communicate with each other. The Department of Public Health report suggested that a lack of communication is a systemic problem. A contributing factor to 22% of deaths reviewed by the report was a lack of continuity of care. Providers lacked access to a patient's full medical record or didn't adequately communicate. For example, an emergency department clinician didn't share a report with the patient's primary care doctor. Mittal said mental health systems are very siloed, and individuals who are trying to seek care are challenged to figure out how to navigate between disconnected systems. Mental health records are protected by strong patient privacy laws, and health systems aren't set up to easily communicate with each other if, for example, an obstetrician refers a patient to a psychiatrist in another health system. Often, the easiest way for a patient to access mental health care is if it's integrated into their medical care. An obstetrician refers a woman to a psychiatrist in the same medical system that takes her insurance. But even when that's not possible, medical systems or insurers can employ navigators, advocates, or social workers to help patients make appointments, find providers, and navigate differences of opinion. Community health workers and postpartum doulas can keep an eye on postpartum women and refer them to care. The Department of Public Health report identified a particular need to help the most at-risk women, ensuring a homeless shelter resident has transportation to medical appointments, or someone with substance use disorder gets support around traumatic events, like custody hearings. The challenge is ensuring that programs and professionals are readily available to all new parents, which takes money. The Department of Public Health, for example, oversees a home visit program to support parents with substance use disorder. But Christina Alonso, director of the Pregnancy, Infancy, and Early Childhood Division in the Bureau of Family Health and Nutrition, told the editorial board that the program, while effective, is only available in 7 locations and is restricted to people who self-identify as using opioids. Expanding it would take approximately $400,000 per new location. Similarly, the legislature passed a maternal health bill in 2024 that expanded statewide a program where a nurse visits a newborn's home once to assess the needs of the caregiver and baby and offer referrals. But Alonso said lawmakers never funded the expansion, which cost around $5 million annually. The biggest need may be for more mental health clinicians, whether by expanding training opportunities or ensuring clinicians are adequately reimbursed. A Massachusetts Healthcare and Human Services Workforce Survey of outpatient mental health and substance use clinics found around 15% of clinician positions were vacant, with clinics reporting a shortage of eligible applicants and inability to offer competitive salaries as major barriers to hiring. If, as a society, we value the health of our children, we must put equal value on ensuring that every mother can get the care she needs to keep not only her baby, but also herself healthy. Editorials represent the views of the Boston Globe editorial board. In final debate, Markey and Moulton trade barbs over who best can advance their party. In the waning days of Massachusetts' contentious Senate primary, the two Democrats sparring for the seat threw punches Thursday with one aim in mind, convincing viewers that they're the better Democrat. Senator Ed Markey and his challenger, Representative Seth Moulton, parried over differences big and small in their third and final primary debate, often agreeing broadly on policy while casting the other as the inferior choice to carry the party's banner on Capitol Hill. Notably, both spent stretches of the final 20 minutes of the hour-long event back on their heels on issues the opponents have used as their biggest cudgels. The debate, co-hosted by WCVB, WBUR, and the Boston Globe, featured an expansion of an apology Moulton previously offered to transgender children, being invoked in the aftermath of the 2024 election, when he said he would not want his two young daughters getting run over on a playing field by a male or formerly male athlete. Three times Thursday, he said he was sorry if he hurt anyone, because that was not my intention, and that he believed transgender athletes should be allowed to participate in girls' sports with a discussion about where we have issues of safety and fairness. Markey, for his part, unequivocally said that they should, before turning the criticism back on Moulton. Congressman Moulton threw those kids under the political bus after the election of 2024. He just turned them into political fodder that made them afraid, the Moulton Democrat said. We should have been loving those kids. With two statewide polls this week showing Markey up by double digits ahead of the September 1 primary, Thursday's showdown offered Moulton, 47, one of his final opportunities to make his case that Massachusetts should not re-elect an 80-year-old senator. His calls for generational change on Capitol Hill appeared to come to the fore when the candidates were asked about their use of artificial intelligence. I use whatever is inside my iPhone or my iPod. Whatever comes up, Markey answered. He later added, it doesn't make any difference whether it's called Siri or it's called Claude. We need to build safeguards around it. Moulton shot back, with all due respect, Senator, if you don't even know what you're using on your phone or your iPad, that's how you need a new generation of leaders to regulate those technologies to make sure they're safe. The congressman, speaking with reporters after the debate, further seized on Markey's response, calling it potentially disqualifying. If he can't even tell the difference between Siri and Claude, we have no hope of him regulating those issues effectively, Moulton said. Markey, for his part, defended his remarks. An automobile, regardless of the make, needs seatbelts, needs airbags, needs brakes, he said. Doesn't make any difference what the make of the car is. In many ways, the event was less feisty than our last showdown, which saw them trade personal attacks and interruptions, accusations of sexism and reprehensible behavior, as well as Moulton lobbing vague allegations involving Jeffrey Epstein. Markey, for the third time on the debate stage, made the case that he's a progressive champion concerned about issues such as climate policy and health care, and is backed by key left-leaning politicians nationwide. He repeatedly name-checked U.S. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley, all of whom endorsed him. No fewer than three times did the senator also call Moulton's remarks ridiculous, including on Moulton's contention that Markey hasn't done enough to help like-minded Democrats win office around the country. The two Democrats agreed on multiple issues, including opposing the Trump administration at every turn, abolishing the Federal Immigration Enforcement Agency, and ending the war in Iran. To boil down their differences, Markey repeatedly argued that on major issues, those are my laws on the books. Moulton's rebuttal, I respect the work that you've done, Senator, and I support it, but it's not enough. Moulton wove his well-worn argument to pass the torch throughout the debate, highlighting a generational fight in Massachusetts playing out as voters elsewhere have selected younger, more progressive candidates in safe blue districts across the country, from New York to Colorado. But Markey, in turn, has tried to center his progressive bona fides while also defending his ability to serve another 6 years. Everyone watching this debate can see I'm more energized than I've ever been before, Markey said. If somebody can't do the job, they should just step down. But I can do the job. Throughout the debate, the two fought for time to criticize the other and make their democratic values known. Asked what is in their grocery cart that costs more these days, Markey said, every item, because this illegal, unconstitutional war in Iran. Moulton said immigration enforcement should be moved back in the Department of Justice. On Thursday afternoon, Moulton said he visited the ICE detention facility in Burlington for an oversight tour and reminded viewers that he was on the ground in Minneapolis after two people were killed by ICE agents last winter. Markey said he called for the abolition of ICE in 2020 and that he was always opposed to its creation. On the subject of a primary care physician shortage, Markey launched into his backing of Medicare for All, an issue on which he's tried to separate himself from Moulton, who has said he supports universal health care. The showdown ended with a moment of levity when the candidates were asked to say one thing they admired about one another. The senator, turning to Moulton, a Marine veteran, said he had tremendous admiration for your service to our country, adding, "We all owe you a debt of gratitude." Moulton, in turn, told Markey he had tremendous respect for your decades of service to this country and this Commonwealth. Wu takes victory lap after end of stadium legal battle. Calling it evidence of the need to take big swings, Mayor Michelle Wu took a victory lap Thursday after the state's highest court rejected a lawsuit trying to halt Boston's $325 million White Stadium overhaul, even as questions remain about the project's timeline. Speaking at Franklin Park on Thursday, Wu said the project is moving full steam ahead, one day after the Supreme Judicial Court ruled in the city's favor for following a years-long legal battle with the Emerald Necklace Conservancy and a coalition of residents who live in the nearby neighborhoods. The SJC's decision eliminated the final legal hurdle for the controversial project, effectively clearing the path forward for construction to continue. The redeveloped stadium, which the city is partnering with the professional women's soccer team Boston Legacy FC to deliver, will be the new hub for Boston Public School athletics and the home stadium for the women's soccer team. The city committed to covering $135 million of the project's estimated price tag. Boston Legacy FC is expected to pay about $190 million. Officials from Boston Legacy FC, top City Hall staff, and local and state leaders joined Wu on Thursday to celebrate the SJC's decision. "We are charting a course that teams and cities around the country are already looking to," Wu said at a news conference behind the William J. Devine Golf Course Clubhouse, situated on the other end of Franklin Park from the stadium. The project has generated substantial scrutiny and opposition over the past 3 years, as critics raised concerns about the project's rising price tag, the city's partnership with a private entity, and the decision to locate a professional sports complex in Franklin Park. Wu has framed the project as an extraordinary opportunity to overhaul the more than 75-year-old dilapidated stadium and give Boston Public School students and city residents access to a professional-grade sports facility without taxpayers having to shoulder the full cost. She said, "Generations of Boston Public School families have been asking the city to renovate the aging stadium. Our Boston kids deserve the very best, and as a city, we can never apologize for fighting to give it to them," she said. But the project's opponents, who filed the initial lawsuit to stop the project in February of 2024, argued it violates constitutional parkland protections and that the neighborhoods around Franklin Park are not an appropriate place for a professional sports stadium. The Supreme Judicial Court ruled Wednesday that the stadium site is a school facility, not parkland, and therefore not subject to those protections. Still, even with that legal victory in hand, it remains unclear when the stadium will be finished and ready to host games and practices, either for students or professionals. Wu did not directly answer questions Thursday about the project's timeline and target completion date, but said construction work is happening on the site 6 days a week and meeting planned milestones. She indicated that the lawsuit over the project had caused some delays. It's undeniable that the litigation process has been a distraction and took significant resources and time and energy, Wu said. So we're evaluating closely, and we'll be working to really fully assess what that means for the remainder of the schedule. Wu and Boston Legacy FC owner Jennifer Epstein on Thursday also did not answer questions about whether the professional women's team plans to host any home games at the White Stadium during the 2027 National Women's Soccer League season, which begins in February. The team is currently playing all its home games this season at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough. Work on the stadium began in early 2025 with the demolition of the old facility, and on Thursday, construction appeared to be back in full swing. The sound of clangs, beeps, and crashes filled the air as excavators rumbled across the site. Two red cranes towered over dozens of laborers in hard hats and fluorescent T-shirts and vests, helping lift long metal rods. As construction continues, a group of elected and community leaders that make up the White Stadium Neighborhood Advisory Council will finalize transportation plans for the 20 Boston Legacy FC game days, Wu said. Residents can share their input on traffic management plans, including game day parking restrictions at four community meetings the city is planning to host in Roxbury, Jamaica Plain, Mattapan, and Dorchester this fall. Babysitter faces murder charge in death of boy. New indictment in Vineyard case. A Martha's Vineyard woman has been indicted on second-degree murder charge for allegedly leaving a two-year-old baby she was babysitting unattended in a vehicle for hours last year before finding him unresponsive. Emma Cotton, 41, was previously charged with manslaughter and child endangerment in the March 2025 death of Frank Rodenbaugh, known as Frankie. The new indictment was returned Wednesday, according to Cape and Islands District Attorney Robert Galibois' office. Cotton is scheduled to be arraigned on murder charge October 5th in Duke Superior Court in Edgartown. Cotton's attorney could not be immediately reached for comment. Prosecutors said they had no further comment until Cotton appears in court. Matt Rodenberg, the boy's father, said the murder charge follows his push for accountability in his son's death. "My two-year-old son Frankie died calling out my name," Rodenberg said in a statement. "I was not there when he needed me most, so I made him this promise after his death. I will be there for him now and forever. I will never stop fighting for Frankie and advocating for the highest measure of justice in his case." He also credited Galibois for deciding to pursue the murder charge. "True justice for Frankie and the safety of other children on this island required it," he said. Ben Migrian, an attorney for the Rodenbaugh family, said the indictment marks a step toward justice for Frankie Rodenbaugh and his family. "It's been an honor to represent Matt Rodenbaugh and watch his relentless fight for his son," Migrian said in a statement. "I commend law enforcement for sustained and continued efforts on the case." Cotton pleaded not guilty in October to manslaughter and child endangerment charges. She was released on $23,800 bail she posted following her initial arraignment in district court. On March 13, 2025, Cotton called 911 and reported that Frankie, whom she was babysitting, was not breathing and had turned blue, according to police report. Cotton initially told investigators she left Frankie and a one-year-old girl in the vehicle for about 15 minutes before finding the boy unresponsive in his car seat, police said. But investigators said security video from Cotton's home showed the children were left in the vehicle for roughly 3 hours. The footage showed Cotton return to her home with the children at about 9:22 a.m. and bring items from the vehicle into the house while the children wait in the car, police said. For the next 3 hours, Cotton is not seen going to her vehicle, nor is anyone seen exiting the vehicle, police wrote. At about 12:15 p.m., Cotton was seen taking the girl inside for about 10 minutes before returning to her car, according to police. Over the next hour, Cotton was seen periodically carrying items from the house to her vehicle, including hockey equipment. When investigators confronted Cotton with discrepancies between her account and the security video, she allegedly acknowledged leaving the children unsupervised in the vehicle for about 3 hours, police said. Cotton told investigators that while the children were strapped into their car seats, she was inside cooking bacon, preparing her son's hockey gear, and doing household chores, according to the report. Police said she allegedly acknowledged she did not provide the children with food or water during that time. At about 1:15 p.m., Cotton was seen opening a rear passenger door in the car, and emergency responders arrived several minutes later, police said. The child was taken to Martha's Vineyard Hospital and later flown to Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. He died 6 days later on March 19th. In a wrongful death lawsuit filed in January, the child's parents accused Cotton of willful and wanton misconduct. The suit said that Cotton suffered hypothermia and a resulting cardiac arrest, which ultimately proved fatal. The lawsuit also alleged Cotton misled emergency responders about the circumstances of the boy's condition, delaying the care he received. A judge issued a stay in the civil lawsuit in June, pending resolution of the criminal case, court records show. What to know about Moderna's huge advance in the world of cancer vaccines? Moderna and Merck are also conducting trials with personalized injections to fight types of bladder, kidney, and lung cancers. Doctors, scientists, and patient advocates are brimming with hope for the future of cancer vaccines after Moderna and Merck announced this week the successful trial result of a personalized messenger RNA treatment for melanoma. The full results weren't released yet, but if they hold up, they would signal a major scientific advancement for patients with the deadliest form of skin cancer and a potential breakthrough in the possibilities for treating other kinds of cancer. Researchers have long sought to harness the body's immune system in a way that accounts for the specifics of each patient's tumor, and the new injection does just that. It's custom-made for each person. Potentially, the most exciting implication from this result is that we might see similar results in other tumor types, some of which are even more common than melanoma, said Dr. David McDermott, Chief of Medical Oncology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Moderna's vaccine, which was given alongside drug maker Merck's blockbuster immunotherapy Keytruda after the cancer was surgically removed, extended how long patients live without their cancer returning, as well as how long they live without their cancer spreading, when compared to Keytruda alone. The vaccine, called Intismerin, was made at Moderna's Marlboro manufacturing facility, tailored to the genetic sequence of a patient's individual cancer. In an earlier stage trial, the therapy reportedly resulted in a 49% reduced risk of the cancer returning or spreading. The latest phase came of Phase 3 trial, the final stage before seeking Food and Drug Administration approval. About 8,510 people are expected to die of melanoma this year in the U.S., and 112,000 new melanomas will be diagnosed this year, according to the American Cancer Society. Moderna is testing its personalized vaccine technology, also in partnership with Merck, on a slate of different cancers. A few Phase 3 trials are targeting non-small cell lung cancers at various stages. Lung cancer of all kind will cause $125,000 deaths in the U.S. this year, according to the American Cancer Society. Phase 2 trials are also ongoing for renal cell carcinoma, the most common kind of kidney cancer. Moderna expects to have an interim analysis or a mid-trial review of how the study is going for the renal cell cancer vaccine either later this year or early next, said David Berman, Moderna's chief development officer. Kidney cancers of all kinds will kill about 15,160 people this year in the U.S., the American Cancer Society estimates. Another phase 2 trial is underway for bladder cancer, which the society estimates will kill 17,870 people in the U.S. this year. The company expects to have results in the bladder cancer trial next year, Berman said. Moderna is also running a phase 2 trial for a vaccine that would treat melanoma that has already spread to other parts of the body. Scientists aren't the only ones closely monitoring these developments. Cancer patients and caregivers are following the news, waiting for shreds of hope that the new treatment options are on the horizon. Chelsea Klein, executive director of Cancer Connection, a nonprofit cancer support center in Northampton and Springfield, said she's cautiously optimistic that the technology could make a difference for patients suffering from other cancers. I lost one of my dearest friends to melanoma, so it's bittersweet, Klein said. If only the treatment had come earlier. But if you can prevent someone from losing their person in the future, that's very exciting. While the mere existence of an effective cancer vaccine is reason for jubilation, another potential boon of Moderna's melanoma therapy candidate is its seemingly limited side effects, Beth Israels McDermott said. The type of drug the vaccine is paired with can make serious and sometimes permanent issues for a small subset of patients, McDermott said, making critical that the vaccine doesn't add even more risk. Moderna's work on cancer has been many years in the making and represent a back-to-the-future moment for the company, said Berman. Though COVID was the disease that made the company a household name, Moderna was originally founded in 2010 to target cancer and other diseases using mRNA, the molecule that carries the genetic instructions needed to make proteins. The COVID and cancer shots are based on different types of targets. Protecting against viruses requires a different part of the immune system than protecting against cancer recurrence, but Moderna found the research and development of each informed the other. At the outset of the pandemic, the country needed a vaccine, and quickly, to protect people against the rapidly spreading COVID virus. It was a task Moderna was uniquely primed to do, Berman said. The whirlwind production and success of the vaccine and its booster shot successors, in conjunction with a similar product from drug makers Pfizer and BioNTech, effectively ended the pandemic threat that claimed more than 1 million U.S. lives, scientists agree. It also made Moderna the target of political backlash, led by noted vaccine and mRNA technology skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr., now Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The federal government, in 2025, severed a $766 million contract with the firm to develop an mRNA vaccine against bird flu. And Moderna faced unusual hurdles by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in the approval of its mRNA flu vaccine for older adults. Moderna tumbled off its pandemic-era high, which had made some of its founders and top executives billionaires. The company cut its Massachusetts workforce by more than 40%, now down to about 2,600 employees. The biotech returned to its cancer roots, this time armed with the experience of producing vaccines in an extreme time crunch. That's particularly important when it comes to cancer vaccines, Berman said, since the development and manufacturing of a personalized therapy has to happen within about 6 weeks from the patient's tumor is sampled. From the identification of the COVID sequence to actually making the first drug was, I think, 42 days, said Berman, who joined the company earlier this year. That speed and turnaround is exactly what's needed in getting this to the patient before they progress. To manufacture the melanoma vaccine therapy, scientists take samples from patients' tumors, identify their unique genetic mutations, then incorporate that information into making several rounds of injectable treatment at the Marlborough facility, Berman said. The vaccine, when injected, helps train the person's immune system to recognize cancer cells to attack. TD Cowen analyst Tyler Van Buren said Wednesday's clinical trial results were a huge deal for Moderna, which was evident when the company's share price closed at more than $174 on Wednesday, nearly triple its price at market close Tuesday. If these data did not hit, then Moderna would have largely been struck as a respiratory illness vaccine company, Van Buren said. But by having this positive trial readout, it transforms the company into an oncology company as well. One ring to burden them all, HBO's Lanterns tells a tale of tense space cops. Television review. Lanterns, starring Kyle Chandler, Aaron Pierre, Laura Linney, Poorna Jagannathan, Kelly MacDonald, Garrett Dillahunt, Nathan Fillion, Jason Ritter, J. Alphonse Nicholson, Jasmine Cephas Jones, Sherman Augustus, Nicole Ari Parker, and Ulrich Thompson. New episodes air Sundays at 9 p.m. on HBO and HBO Max through October 4. Some superhero series are serious and almost self-consciously grim. Others aim for a more jugular vein, interested in laughs before portent. Lanterns tries to split the difference and often succeeds. The latest DC Comics offering, which premiered Sunday on HBO and HBO Max, presents a buddy story in the form of a geopolitical allegory and a deftly cast pairing of mentor and protege on a mission to save the world. When it doesn't lapse into near incoherence, visually and narratively, it makes for a high-stakes action yarn with a human and superhuman touch. It also's got Kyle Chandler, who is a way of livening up any party. Here, he plays Hal Jordan, a jaded mess of a superhero whose powers derive from the green ring he wears on his finger. Hal is a Lantern, an intergalactic cop tasked by the Guardians, not to be confused with Marvel's Guardians of the Galaxy, to police space crime. The glowing green ring needs to be charged on a regular basis. Bedraggled and a little burned out, Hal has developed a bit of a resentment toward the whole deal. The resentment spikes to new levels when he's tasked to mentor an up-and-coming Lantern, John Stewart, Aaron Pierre, a serious young man who's been trained to be a Lantern since he was a wee lad. Fans of the DC Universe, and the Green Lantern mythology in particular, will recognize some of this background from prior consumption. But I've always felt the best measure of a such series should be how well a newcomer can acclimate the details without consulting a wiki page. As a mere comics dilettante, I freely admit this is a self-serving philosophy. And Lanterns does well on this score. For a time, anyway. The show's prime pleasures come from character dynamics, rather than a storyline that has a way of twisting itself into pretzel logic, and from casting, a strength that extends from the leads to the supporting players. But Lanterns also has worldly concerns on its mind, and their murkiness somehow feels appropriate for the world in which we live. Hal is falling out of favor with the all-powerful Guardians, largely because of his strategic relationship with a war criminal, Ulrich Thomason's Sinestro. John, eager to seize the ring from the mentor he sees as unworthy to wear it, is seduced by a femme fatale, Poorna Jagannathan, from The Night Off, with some mysterious connections. There's a wealthy rancher, Garrett Dillahunt, who lords over the Nebraska town where much of the action and carnage takes place, and alien overlord, Laura Linney, ruthlessly seeking stability and a new galactic order. There's a lot of stuff going on here, and the geopolitics are a bit overstuffed. So Lanterns and its creators, Chris Mundy, Tom King, and Dame Lindelof of Lost in the Leftovers fame, are wise to lean into the ambiguity of Hal and John's relationship, which wafts somewhere between reluctant collaboration, grudging affection, and outright hostility. Hal is a sloppy cynic who isn't above using the magic ring to conjure a bottle opener when he offers a beer to a Nebraska sheriff. Kelly MacDonald, great as always. John, pushed to become a Lantern from childhood by his ambitious parents, is a soulful stoic with a military bearing. Like many a Tolkien character, he really wants that ring. Chandler and Pierre, who bring some of the same inner fire that defines his Malcolm X in the series Genius MLK/X, creates a friendly tension that gets less friendly as Lanterns progress. The lighter moments of Lanterns bring to mind the Men in Black franchise, another universe in which the presence of space aliens is an accepted fact, and a pair of oddly matched agents to try to tack them down. At times, the new series even shares the MIB sense of flippant, wide-open fun. But on balance, this is a grimmer affair. Its characters operate in a darker, more dangerous, and despite the big-budget mayhem, more reality-based world. The series does some of its best work with young John and his parents, played by J. Alphonse Nicholson and Jasmine Cephas Jones in one time frame, and Sherman Augustus and Nicole Ari Parker in another. There's urgency in their desire to see their son become a fearless space cop, and trepidation over what it means for a black man to proclaim his fearlessness in America. Lanterns can grow muddled in both its action sequences, some of which seem to confuse chaos for excitement, and its storytelling, which squeezes a whole lot of data points into its 8-episode maiden series. But it works whenever Chandler and Pierre share the screen and share their frenemy energy. In Lanterns, great power doesn't mean great responsibility. It also carries tremendous burden, and you can see it etched in these actors' faces. Heavy lies the hand that wears the ring. And talking points for August today, 21st. Grocery. Big Y keeps expanding east. Its next stop? Norton. Big Y is continuing its push into eastern Massachusetts, announcing plans for a new supermarket in Norton, expected to open in early 2028. The new 48,000-square-foot store will open at Greatwood Marketplace at 175 Mansfield Avenue. The Norton store is the latest step in Big Y's expansion beyond its traditional western Massachusetts territory. The family-owned grocery chain recently opened a new location in Pembroke and is preparing to open another in Saugus. It also plans to open stores in Fairhaven and North Dartmouth in 2027. In April, Big Y told Boston.com that it's pursuing an ambitious expansion strategy as it works towards 100 stores by its 100th anniversary in 2036. The company has said it's looking for the right opportunities as it expands, rather than rapidly opening stores across the region. The Norton store will add to Big Y's growing footprint, which includes about 80 stores across Massachusetts and Connecticut. The supermarket chain employs more than 10,000 people who operate Big Y supermarkets, Table and Vine Fine Wine, Beer and Liquor, and Big Y Express Fuel and Convenience locations. School. Harvard Feeder School that JFK attended to borrow $35 million. A Boston-area prep school that taught President John F. Kennedy is planning to borrow almost $35 million to upgrade his classrooms and athletics facilities. Founded in 1866 to prepare boys to attend Harvard University, the Noble and Greenough School will use the proceeds of the bond sale to pay for renovating its primary academic building, as well as an athletic facility that houses an ice rink in the winter and tennis courts in the spring, according to bond documents. Private schools across the country are borrowing funds to remodel their campus facilities, as the competition to attract and retain students gets more intense due to a shrinking number of school-age kids. For instance, students who partake in 5-day boarding at Noble and Greenough's sprawling campus in Dedham this year will pay $74,800 in annual tuition, while day students will be charged $68,500. The school became co-ed in 1975 and is expecting nearly 640 students between grades 7 and 12 this year, according to bond documents. Many grads go on to attend institutions like Harvard, Boston College, and Georgetown University. The estimated cost of both Noble's campus projects is $68.5 million, and the school will pay for the remainder with philanthropic group gifts, according to a presentation to bond investors. The school debt offering will be offered by the Massachusetts Development Fund Agency and carry an AA- grade from S&P Global Ratings. The deal is expected to price September 1. Higher education. Foreign students applying to U.S. colleges fell 10% this year. The number of international students applying to attend U.S. colleges this fall tumbled about 10%, according to data released Thursday by the country's most widely used college application platform. Nearly 16,000 fewer foreign students vied for spots at U.S. colleges this year than in 2025, as the Trump administration ramped up efforts to restrict overseas students from entering the country, including by changing visa rules, according to a report released Thursday by the Common App. The report surveyed 1,146 schools, up 4% from the 2024-2025 school year. The drop is the clearest signal yet that American universities are likely to see steep international enrollment declines this fall. That will add to the mounting financial pressures facing many American colleges, already hit by a shrinking number of university-age students and questions about the value of higher education. The Common App report showed double-digit declines in applications from Asia and Africa, but the number of European students applying to American campuses also fell by 4%, reversing years of steady increases. That came after countries including France and Germany stepped up efforts to attract students disillusioned with the prospect of a U.S. education. Their number of domestic college applicants, meanwhile, rose by 4%, driven largely by a 9% surge from the Southwest. During the 2024-25 application cycle, which ended shortly after the Trump White House first began its crackdown on student visa holders, the number of foreign applicants fell by just 1% from 2023-24. Rodney Hughes, Common App senior data scientist, said the recent plunge was the largest they've seen since they started collecting digital data in 2013. Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Boston Globe. I hope all of you have a great weekend.